To another episode of Vertical Momentum, where we talk to today's thought leaders and game changers. And today is a definite gentleman coming on game. He's changing the whole game. I want to thank our sponsors, which you guys know as a veteran, all my sponsors are veterans, veteran-owned companies 100% of the time. When I was on active duty, I got hooked on energy drinks, but as I get older, I can only have one a day, so I choose a product called Physics Zero, which is very low stim, but enough energy and gives me focus with no sugar. And so it's Physics Zero by Bonvera. Thank you so much, Jason Lane Curtis, for sponsoring the show. We love you, brother. Guys, today we have an amazing gentleman come on. I first heard him on Tom's show, and he blew my mind. I had to listen to the episode three different times. He's an author. He's just changing the whole game on resilience. Rich, welcome to the show, my friend. How are you today?
Oh, great. Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Oh, man, your episode on Tom's episode, like I said, it blew me away. I listened to it three times because I had another podcast called Success, Your Why Powers Your How. And it's amazing when you kept talking about a person finding their why before they do anything else. And that's what really intrigued me about yourself. I got to ask you, your last name.
Yes.
You know, what nationality? Because I'm Italian. That's all. I just wanted to see what nationality it was.
Yes, often confused for Italian, but it's actually Irish. So, yeah.
Okay, so how do you pronounce your name?
Divini, yeah.
Okay, because I was like, wait a minute, is he Italian? What?
Yeah, I'm actually, my mom always says we're actually mutts, which is nice because, you know, my grandfather was Maltese Italian, my grandmother was Greek, my dad's family was Irish, you know, so we're really just mutts, which is good because mutts live a long time. So
yeah, and they don't have a lot of issues that purebreds have.
Right. So
how's your week going so far?
So far, so good. Yeah, it's you know, it's Tuesday. It's the weeks are starting to feel a little bit more like weeks as we, I hope, see the light at the end of the tunnel of all this stuff. You know, it's so hard to distinguish day by day sometimes as we went through 2020. But yeah, it's Tuesday, and it's so far so good. How about yours?
Everything is going great. Like I said, I just had my first only energy drink of the day. So, and I get to hang out with you. So life is amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've actually talked to some people that you actually were in service with,
mm-hmm.
and even went to buds
yeah.
with. So, and the biggest thing that takeaway that I've heard, you know, a lot of times when you hear, you know, people that serve with other people, they're like, oh, well, he was a warrior. But most people talked about your heart that I've talked to. And they said you had one of the biggest hearts that they've ever met. So where did you get your heart of service from?
Wow, that's such a compliment. Especially in a warrior culture, it's good to know that. Gosh, you know, I don't know. I mean, I, you know, probably my family. I think my you know, my family was the beginning of it. I had a really nice upbringing, great parents, very supportive and encouraging, and really, you know, my mom, again, my mom knows seven languages fluently. She knew five languages by the time she was 5 years old. And so she's really brilliant and very worldly. And so, you know, you can't help but get a bunch of open-mindedness from that type of aspect. And my dad, you know, a lawyer, and kind of always really, he actually never pushed us down any lanes. He just said, hey, it was almost like he just said, hey, I want you to do what you want to do. And he really gave us space to do that. So I think it started there. And, you know, I have two wonderful brothers, one wonderful sister. And so great family life first. And then of course, you know, the teams, were an influence. And of course my wife, I've been married to my wife for, you know, 20 plus years, and she's one of the kindest, most empathetic people I've ever met. And so she of course has rubbed off on me. So I think, you become the people you surround yourself with, and that's probably what happened.
So what kind of little boy was Rich?
You know, I was, you know, I always consider myself a very average kid. I was an average student. I was an average athlete. I was mischievous, just like any other kid was. Not overly so, but you know, but had my fair share. And but you know, ultimately, I was always curious, and I love the idea of challenging myself and discovery. And my twin brother, I have a twin brother. And he and I, from a very early age, wanted to be Navy pilots. My dad was a private pilot, so he used to take us flying all the time. And he and my brother and I were just hooked. And we said, you know, wow, we have to be jet pilots. And of course, the Navy was attractive because the Navy guys landed their jets on ships, which was like, oh my God, it doesn't get harder. I mean, it can't be any harder than that, right? So the challenge of that really was something that drew me in. And then I learned about SEALs really just after the first Gulf War in the early 90s. I didn't know what SEALs were, and then when I learned about them and started reading about them, I was like, wow, these guys are pretty cool. They do everything. And of course the training was really tough too. So I think I was just kind of always driven to try to I always kind of for some reason wanted to step out to my edges and explore my edges and see what I could do. And so that's kind of been a somewhat of a motto my whole life.
Now, I love, I've talked to, a couple, Navy SEALs lately, and, they're all, and they're not, for me, they're not what I expected when I first met them, like Brent Gleason and those guys, they were totally not what I would have thought.
Yeah.
You got a totally different breed. And, when I've talked to, operators, you guys are very cerebral. I'm noticing, very well read. Was that something that were you always a reader?
I was always a reader. Yeah, and it was actually it was a pleasant surprise. I had started reading about the Navy SEALs, and I recognized just because of the nature of special operations, they were different, and they had to be more cunning and just, you know, kind of thought, you know, kind of a little bit, kind of a little bit different, right? And so it was really cool for me to think about and to realize when I got to SEAL training that all these guys, I was surrounded by guys like this, and it wasn't even, you know, it wasn't even just the, you know, obviously the college or the officers were college graduates, and that's one form of education, but the enlisted guys were so diverse in where they came from. I mean, there were a bunch of enlisted guys who actually, I had one guy in my bud's class who was a he had a degree in nuclear physics, and he didn't want to go officers, and he just decided to enlist in the Navy. And so and even the guys who hadn't been to college, most a lot of them had, the enlisted guys, but even the guys who hadn't just had this incredible appetite for knowledge. And I think the what really was cool was the dichotomy of it all, right? There were just so much, even though you could call the group fairly hegemonic in terms of the drive and the grit and things like that. The diversity in terms of background and perspectives and things like that was just really cool. So it was cool to have a team kind of come form together. And I literally felt like I was surrounded by superheroes. I was like, man, these people are so much better than me. And ironically, as I got to know these guys and they became my brothers and teammates, I realized they felt the same way themselves about everybody around them. So really, it was a group of people and individuals who consistently like to try to surround themselves with people who they felt could up their game. And it's just a really cool place to be.
I love everybody's recruiting story because everybody has a different recruiting story. So what was your recruiting story like? Did you just walk in and say, "Hey, I want to be a Navy SEAL?"
Well, interesting enough, because I was bent on being a Navy pilot, I knew that I had to go to college and I knew I had to get commissioned as an officer. So I had already gone down that pathway of getting a commission as I started thinking about the SEAL team. So I was in Navy ROTC at Purdue University, and I said to myself, well, I think I want to be a Navy SEAL, but there was no real distinct pathway on how to do that. And the folks at the unit had never had a SEAL, had never had a midshipman go to SEAL training. And so what's interesting is my dad, who's a lawyer in Connecticut and has been for 50 years, he mentioned to me, he said, you know, I have a client who is a former, I mentioned to him that you wanted to be a Navy SEAL, and he said he was a former underwater demolition team member. So for your audience, those who might know, the UDT were the predecessors to the SEALs. I mean, it all started with the underwater demolition teams, and Draper Kaufman and the early 40s to prepare for the D-Day invasion. The UDTs were formed. This guy was on the was a UDT during these invasions, and he was an avid photographer. And so I said, I'd love to meet this guy. So I was home one summer vacation, from college, and I met this guy. His name was Barry McCabe. And Barry and I sat down, and he showed me all of his photo albums of when he was on the beaches of Japan and the Pacific. And man, they were so incredible. And he just told these stories, and I was like, man, this. And I just loved the water. I loved everything about the ocean. I loved being in the water, underwater, everything about it. So it just this kind of frogman philosophy really resonated with me. And he said, I know this captain. He's a reserve captain who helps guys try to get to SEAL training, by helping them with their, PT scores. And he introduces them to current SEALs to get recommendations. And so that's what I did. I got with a guy named Captain Drew Bissett, and interviewed with some SEALs, with a bunch of SEALs, passed my PT test, and put in my application. And sure enough, I got picked up, and I was the first midshipman from Purdue University to go to SEAL training, which was cool. And that was it. And then I showed up at the beaches of Coronado, and once you're there, it's all on you at that point. So the recruiting story got me to Buds, and then of course going through Buds is its own other challenge.
I talked to John McCaskill. We were talking last week, and we were talking about you had to have a certain mentality to make it. And the guys that got there that were all ripped and shredded and were PT, PT studs, a lot of them didn't make it because they didn't have the mentality
Right.
of never quit. And that's what John and Brent, that's what they were all saying is that if you had the mentality of just do that one more push-up.
Right.
Do that one more, whatever it was, just do one more. So what was your mindset like? I know, you heard the bell rung many times. What was your mindset like? Because, a lot of people, when we get out of the military, we forget what made us good in the military.
Yeah.
So we're talking about mindset. So what was your mindset like when going through, Hell Week and Buds?
Well, so John and Brett are absolutely right, and I'd almost I so I'm fascinated with kind of going to the very, very elemental things, so I'd take what they said, and I'd dive into it kind of almost to the atomic level and say, okay, what is it that causes someone to say, just do one more push-up, just do one more step, just do one more? And what it is it's an ability to understand and compartmentalize in a way that says, hey, even though everything around me seems like it's crumbling and it seems like everything's sub-zero in terms of my ability to move, my physicality, my temperature, because I'm so cold or whatever, I'm just going to focus on the next moment. That's it. And whatever that distance is between now and the next moment, whatever I choose that to be, the next moment could be the next meal, or the next moment could be the next day, or the next moment could be the next step, right? But the ability to chunk your environment in a way that allows you to forget about everything else and just move to the next step, move to the next moment, and then continuously do that throughout a process is what every Navy SEAL has in common. And I would say that the ripped athletes who didn't make it, to give some of the ripped athletes some credit, there were some ripped athletes who did make it, right? It wasn't all the, so some of those guys did make it. But the difference is, I think, for those who made it and those who didn't, regardless of how athletic you were coming in, were that whatever allowed each one of us to get to those beaches of San Diego to start Buds, whatever that process was to get there, involved inside of it some practice in just taking it step by step and really grinding it out and gutting it out and understanding and being comfortable with this idea that, hey, I don't know a lot about what's going on around me right now, and nor can I control it, but I'm going to focus on what I can control and move to that. And then once I get there, I'm going to kind of look out again and choose again what to focus on and move to that. And it becomes a step-by-step process. And that is remarkably valuable for military life and specifically SEAL life. And especially, we had a very kinetic time frame, right? But combat is like that. I mean, combat, there's no time to worry about those things you can't control. You must continue to step through until the mission, until the fight is won, until the mission's accomplished. And Buds trains you for that, and kind of hyper develops that ability. So I think that's the atomic level of the mindset.
So what was the moment when you finally figured out that you made it through Hell Week? What was that, how were you feeling at that moment? 'Cause even those guys were talking about it, they said it was such a relief just to have a feel a little bit normal again after showers and stuff. So what was that moment like?
Well, I still count it to I count that moment, and it's funny because I remember getting secured from Hell Week, which is a Friday afternoon, and then you go and you have pizza and you shower and you go to bed and you sleep for like 18 hours, but what really sticks with me was the next morning. I remember, Friday when we finished Hell Week, it was kind of a cloudy day in San Diego. It was cold. Everything was cold, of course, but it was just kind of cloudy and mucky and murky, and we kind of we had pizza and stuff, and we went to bed, had Gatorade. But I remember getting up that Saturday morning, and it was a crystal clear, beautiful day. And my little brother lived in San Diego at the time, and so he picked me up from Bud's. And I remember kind of limping out through the quarter deck to where he picked me up. And he picked me up, and I got into his car, and we went to where he was staying. And then he had to go to work, and so I just kind of hung out in his apartment, and I just used the, I played games on the computer. I called my family to tell me. Actually, I think we had breakfast first, but I called my family, and that to me is it sticks out as one of the best days of my life. Of course, I count in that like the birth of my kids, marrying my wife. There's a lot of highlights, but that day, that Saturday morning, was probably the first time I really let it sink in. And said to myself, man, that's really cool. But what's interesting, and I'm not sure if those guys talked about the phenomenon of post Hell Week depression, but there's a phenomenon called post Hell Week depression, and so it's a very real thing, and I had heard about it beforehand. I experienced it afterwards, and it was a really weird. And that mean that what post Hell Week depression is that you've geared yourself up. I mean, Hell Week's the 5th week of SEAL training, right? So you've geared yourself up for 5 weeks or for 4 weeks getting ready for Hell Week. And then you go through Hell Week. And it's such a major accomplishment that once you're done, you feel like, oh my God, I mean, I just tackled this thing that was so intensely tough, right? And there's a point at which, after that kind of settles in, that you realize you still have like 4.5 months to go of Bud's training, because Bud's training is 6 months long, and when that sinks in, there's almost a depression that sets in that says, you know what, this is not over. I still, we still have to do this. I still have to do this for 4.5 more months. And I think that's also part of the training, because it almost trains you to say, hey, even though you make these accomplishments like that, you have to kind of come back to baseline and keep moving, because the overall goal still is in front of you, and you can't get seduced by the highs, you can't get crushed by the lows, you have to keep going. So that it was interesting to kind of feel those two polarities after something like Hell Week.
And one thing I really appreciate about you is, you talk a lot about, enjoying the process, because everything has, you have to, it's usually never, like if you win a marathon, it's usually after you win, it's kind of like, yeah, but I really enjoyed the process of, getting in shape to be able to do it. So what was it like, knowing when you got your pinned on your trident, knowing that the work was just beginning.
Well,
No, it just
yeah.
it was kind of like one continuous
Well,
process.
there's always excitement because I kind of think about it in terms of kind of exploring your edges, walking out to your edges, and then once you reach one edge, you're now at a new vista and you can see the next edge, right? It's kind of like seeing the next, you can't see the you head out to the horizon so that you can see the next horizon. And so that's kind of how I approach the whole thing. I think I think the process going through training like that, what you come out of with is what I would define as true confidence. And the way I would define true confidence is the ability to know that no matter how tough or bad an environment gets around me, I will make it through. I have what it takes to think through the issue and to persevere and make it through. And that, I think, is true confidence. You come out of SEAL training with that, and that just gets hammered in as you go through your SEAL career, especially if you are, fortunate enough to, do the job and go to combat. Because again, we were able to live our SEAL lives through a very kinetic time where we actually got to do the job of Navy SEALs. And that's not common. People kind of, I think, misunderstand that they kind of think that SEALs are out there working all the time, doing missions and things like that. And that's just not the case. Your missions are when there's no war and conflict are very, very hard to come by, highly selective. It takes a lot to approve and things like that. So there are guys who go through a career and they never get to do any real world missions. It's all training. It's all preparation. So we got to do that. And even though I'd say war is holistically bad, it's, we should all make sure we think very deeply before engaging in something like war. It's also necessary at times, of course, but it was still, a gift in some ways to be able to go do a job and do it for your country and do what you had trained to do. So, and you do that with that deep confidence you get out of that training.
And a question I have, another question I normally don't ask, but I just feel lit. Was your faith as strong as it is then as it is now?
Well, yeah. And so I think for me, I have over the years, thought deeply about what faith means to me. And I think from a keep it in a kind of a human performance realm, for me, I always wanted to make sure that the faith was in myself and in my teammates, because you lean on these guys so much, you trust them and then you trust yourself and you know, hey, we will figure this out. We'll get through it. And so aside from the depth of analysis and thought I did at the kind of religious levels of faith, because I did a lot of that too, the faith in myself and my teammates never wavered and only got stronger throughout that whole process.
Now, how many, I'm sure you've been on numerous, too many deployments and too much action to talk about, but how many years did you put in the teams?
I did just under 21 years. So, some are around 13 deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, and then a handful of others to other locations. A lot of time away from the family.
Now, were you married during this time in the
Yeah, teams? So ironically, for the first 5 years I was in the teams, I was not married. I joined the teams in 1996. So, and I met my wife in January 2001, and we were married in July 2001. You know, we pretty much knew we wanted to marry each other. And I remember proposing to her and I said, the SEAL teams, it's an interesting life. I'll deploy now and then. There's workups, I kind of laid out what it looks like in terms of timing. So a lot of training, things like that. But, I think, obviously we're in it together. And she was like, yep, right, we got this. And sure enough, 2 months later, September 11th happened and everything changed. And so she was with me through all the times. We had two kids during that, and she was always supportive. She was always there. I have to tell you, probably the hardest thing for me out of anything about my career was leaving the family every time. That was always the hardest thing because it just, you can't, well, you know, the veterans on that, you and the veterans who are listening to this know that there's, you just can't describe that feeling to other people when you have to say goodbye to your loved ones for that long. It's an indescribable feeling, and that was always the hardest for me. And that's really when we talk about the sacrifice that our military members make. That's of course there's obviously life and limb and things like that, but even those who don't lose life or limb, the sacrifice of their time away from their loved ones is a huge one. that we all need to be grateful for.
And, you know, like, I know, you know, my wife, I consider, you know, she's my bride. Known her for over 30 years. And, you know, even when I was in the military, you know, I always found that if everything is okay at home, it takes a lot of burden off of you can focus on your mission abroad.
It does. Yeah, it does. And that's why you need a strong partner because that's such the case. And the strong partners will deliberately shield you from burden when you're overseas, because they know there's certain things you don't need to worry about. And I know your wife probably did it, and my wife did as well. And interestingly enough, we even, especially during the most kinetic combat times, we would decide to talk like once a week instead of, you know, we had the communications in my day, you know, in the 2000s, we had the communications. We could call home every night if we wanted to, you know. But you realize that didn't work. First of all, it made the deployment longer. And second of all, it created an expectation around and a regularity around kind of talking that just the environment sometimes didn't support. And so if we just waited once and just say, hey, we'll talk once a week, it alleviated a lot of that pressure. So you kind of learn those nuances with your partner. And then, of course, once you add kids into the mix, it becomes even more complex, but you have to learn those nuances with the kids as well.
And I've noticed, I mean, that women in general, not every woman, but women in general, pretty much they have like a sixth sense where if something is a little off, my wife will tell me, and I'm going to trust her 99.9% of the time because she's right almost 100% of the time.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I would almost, you know, it's interesting because I think I've experienced that, I've seen that and I've seen it happen with any spouses, right? Because obviously there's a lot of women serving overseas as well. And so you have the men spouses who are staying back or any partner, in whatever flavor that is. But when you have that type of emotional relationship, I think there's an intuitiveness to it, and there's a sixth sense that has developed such that that you can be supportive that way and know, hey, okay, there's something off, or we need to kind of figure that out or dial it in or talk more. It's really important to have that relationship be solid.
So, you know, now we're going to talk about, you know, you're transitioning out. You know, I've talked, like you said, hundreds of veterans, and, you know, some of the things they tell me, the number one thing they miss the most is the camaraderie. You know, they miss their teammates. Number two is they don't have a mission anymore. Mm-hmm. For me, I was so built up to being Sergeant Kaufman that when I got medically discharged 10 years ago, I didn't know who Richard was. So I kind of like had to find out who I was and had to rebuild myself. What was now when you transitioned out, did you notice something was off mentally?
Well, interestingly enough, I think there's a difference sometimes between when you transition out. And so the only reason I'll say this, because I have friends who transitioned out at like 8 years or 6 years or 10 years, right? I transitioned at 20 plus years, right? So in terms of the job, I had pretty much done everything I wanted to do inside the military. I was at a position where I was starting to rank out of kind of the SEAL stuff, if you know what I mean, right? So for me, the transitioning out of the job was very, very easy. I was looking forward to another challenge, another edge, if you will, to kind of explore. So I would definitely put myself in the category of someone who says that I try not to, you know, I don't, for me, the word miss is tough because it at least for me, it implies a longing. And so I don't long for that time frame. I kind of try to see it as a time frame I'm very grateful for. If I were back in the teams, I would not be I'd be an 06 and I'd be doing stuff on a staff and I wouldn't be kind of with the team guys. And so I wouldn't be in that environment where I'd be like with the guys the times that I really, really enjoyed. So I try to say to myself, I look very fondly back on those times that we were, those camaraderie times, the times where you're just with your guys and you're just, I mean, you're laughing so hard, you're crying, right? Because you're around a fire out in Iraq or even, I mean, some of the most miserable situations, some of the funniest things happen. This is where humor really comes into play. And I think that's one of the superpowers of high performing teams, and specifically military teams, is that humor is used so brilliantly to kind of keep you going. And so my transition was not really, I welcomed it. I would say that I felt the unease of just jumping and throwing myself into a new environment. And I did feel a little bit of unease kind of being by myself, because in the military, you seem like you're always with, especially the teams, there's always people around you. There's always people you can kind of lean on. They're going through the same thing you are, and jumping out into an environment of being on my own and trying to kind of forging my own path was definitely unique and definitely uncomfortable. But I sought out that discomfort because I knew it was an edge I needed to conquer. So it was kind of a little bit of both for me, I think. But for the most part, I was happy to be transitioning because my kids are now teenagers, right? And I transitioned 4 years ago, and it was just, I'm now home, and it's kind of the meat of their growth and the time of their life where they really, really need a dad. I mean, I think kids, as they're in their younger ages, they definitely need mom a lot, and certainly they need dad too, if possible. But when they're, teenage boys, they need their dad. They really do. And to be home here with them, I was just enormously grateful for.
I love that. Now, when I interview somebody, I hang on every word, and sometimes there's key words that I actually count how many times they're used. And you've used the word edge 5 times so far. So what is it like, I was a tank commander. So, I always had that excitement. There was always that thrill. Yeah. So when you got out, how did you fulfill that, thrill?
Yeah. Well,
what was that like?
Yeah, well, so thrill is, it can mean a couple of things. It can mean excitement, like deep excitement. It could also mean like fear and anxiety, right? So for me, I think edges, for me at least, edges are defined as those steps out into the unknown that explore my potential. And for me, that means, okay, I need to explore some of those things that might make me feel anxious or uncomfortable. Because that's an edge that, and I relate it, because I've always hated heights, right? I just don't like them. And so walking up to an edge of something high makes me nervous. And so I kind of relate it to the same thing, is what are those things that could make me nervous? And so for example, I said to myself, well, I had an opportunity to kind of join the leadership space and work with a company out of St. Louis who did leadership, and a buddy of mine, Simon Sinek, who's an author in the leadership space. And that job was going to require me to give talks in front of hundreds of people and to teach classes in front of people. And that really kind of made me uncomfortable and nervous. And I said to myself, okay, if it's making me uncomfortable and nervous, I should probably conquer that edge. And so I deliberately stepped into that. So I think that was my walk into the edge. And I started getting pretty good at it and started getting comfortable. And I said, okay, the next edge is writing a book. I want to try that endeavor because I've always loved writing, and that's an edge, and it's on my own. It's my ideas, and how that feels. So I'm one of those people who's consistently trying to look for the next thing so that I can just, I think growth is, I mean, well, yeah, I believe growth is just moving to your edge and then getting good at it and then finding the next one and just expanding your arc as much as possible. And expanding your arc is going to require stepping out to those edges of discomfort and uncomfortable and stress and anxiety so that you might grow.
I love that. And when I talk to people, veterans, a lot of veterans, when they get out of the military, it seems to be now more than ever, they either want to open up a t-shirt hat company, coffee company, or liquor company within, 6 months, they're $10,000 in debt and don't know what the hell right. happened. And a lot of it is, I think, is attributed to they never had that hard conversation with their significant other at the coffee table. about what was going, what their plans were for the future. So can you take us to that kitchen table and talk, you know, when you and your wife were talking about, all right, this is what I want to do. You know, how did that conversation go?
Yeah. So thank goodness my wife has always been someone who's supported me in exploring my edges, because I've tried to do it in a way that, that it, you know, has risk, but mitigates risk for the family. And so, and that's probably my background too. You kind of say, okay, I'm going to, every SEAL mission is about, okay, how, this is a very risky mission. How can we best mitigate risk and then go on this thing? Understand the risk is always going to be there, but you do your best to kind of control the things you can and then minimize that which you can't. And so I think for us, it was really having that discussion in terms of, okay, what are those things that I'm really interested in doing and exploring? What are the pros and the cons of that? And how does that fit into the plan? And so part of that was, we knew I had, you know, we both knew I had to kind of get my footing in the world on my own, in the world of leadership and speaking in front of people. And so I took a job with this leadership company out of St. Louis, wonderful group. And that was a salaried position. And I took a pay cut, you know, looking at like what I had been making in the Navy. I deliberately took a pay cut because I knew, hey, this is a chance for me to learn and grow and just kind of get good at this in an environment that reduces and mitigates that risk. And I did that for about a year. And then I said, okay, I'm done with that. I want to now be an independent contractor. So I moved out and became an independent contractor and started just working my own stuff and just kind of stepped it up a little bit. And she was always supportive of that because she knew, well, A, she had faith in me because she'd been married to me, you know, for my whole career. So she knew that I was someone who'd keep on going. But B, there was always a discussion. And I think the discussions that veterans sometimes don't have at that dinner table are, what are the risks here? But also an acknowledgement that it is, I don't know the percentages, Richard, but we could probably look this up, but I think it's like 95% chance that the job you get coming out of the military, you won't have in 1 or 2 years after being in the military. In other words, you'll switch jobs. You'll find that it's not for you. You'll change. You know, it's just, there's a process that every transitioning veteran has to go through when they're finding their way. And part of finding their way is going to be shifting around, changing jobs, figuring out what's a good fit, because they've just come from this very defined and contained environment where everything makes sense and everything's kind of structured and the pathway's clear. And they're going into this new environment that the pathway's unclear, and that's going to take some flexibility and adaptability. So I think having that conversation about what are the ultimate goals, what's the why, and then an acceptance of flexibility, adaptability, and patience, I think are the most important things.
And, you know, like, I love your book, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I've read it a couple times now. Ever since I knew we were going to talk, I had to dig deep into it. So there are certain attributes that successful ultra high performers have. But the one that kind of threw me for a loop, and I had to, you know, sit back and read and think about it, was narcissism. Yeah. How can that be a positiveness? How can that be a positive
attribute? Yeah. Well, one of the things I'm really interested and fascinated with human behavior and what causes people to do the things they do, especially in times of challenge, uncertainty, and stress. But even like what causes people to kind of be able to set and achieve audacious goals. And so when I wrote the book and I kind of started bucketing these attributes into these categories. So what are the ones that make up grit? What are the ones that make up mental acuity, leadership, team ability, and drive? I had to reconcile myself with this one question, which was, why did I become a Navy SEAL in the first place? All right. And when I was really honest with myself about that answer, now there's probably a couple answers in there, okay? It's not just one, but when I was honest about myself with a specific answer, it was because I wanted to be a badass, okay? I wanted to try to do something that very few people could do. I wanted to try to be a part of a community that very few people could and had what it took to be a part of. And then I would ask guys around me the same question, and they would all agree. It was like, of course, yeah. You just, I mean, let's be honest with ourselves. Yes, we're all patriots. Yes, we love our country, and that's that's part of the reason why we wanted to join the military. But why is it that you wanted to be a Navy SEAL? So, well, you wanted to be special. You wanted to stand out. And that's what narcissism is when you just boil it down to the definition. It's the desire to stand out, to be recognized, be noticed, be admired, be adored. And so if we think about the human element of this, right? Now, narcissism, just let's level a bubble here. Narcissistic personality disorder is a bad thing, okay? It's a codified psychological disorder. The DSM-5, which is kind of a psychological Bible, will lay out 9 criteria, like sentences criteria, that that if you have 5 or more, you officially have that disorder. But the disordered personality, the narcissistic personality, is actually fairly rare in society. And when you look at the DSM-5 and you look at these criteria, while it's probably hard for most of us to agree with 5 or more of them, there are certainly aspects of 1 or 2 or 3 or even 4 that you're like, okay, yeah, I could see myself feeling that way, doing that thing. And so I started thinking, okay, what does this have to do with human behavior and neurology? And the fact is, when we are infants and we are being paid attention to and adored by our parents, for example, we are getting hit with 3 very powerful chemicals, 2 neurotransmitters and 1 hormone. Neurotransmitter dopamine, which is, we all know, it's a feel-good chemical. It tells our whole system, hey, this feels great, keep doing it. It's why it's one of the primary chemicals of addiction. So dopamine, we're getting dopamine. We're getting serotonin, which is a chemical that floods us and allows us to feel safe and protected and valued, okay? Then we're getting hit with the hormone, which is oxytocin, which is the love connection chemical, which we've all heard of, the love chemical, the love hormone. So we're our body, when we're getting adored as an infant by our parents, we're getting flooded with those chemicals. It's why it feels so good. Well, this doesn't change when we're adults, okay? It still feels that way when we're getting paid attention to and adored and admired by others, okay? When we're getting that standing ovation after a speech, when we're getting that award that we worked very hard for, the promotion or whatever, we feel flooded with those same chemicals. So it's perfectly normal for every single human being at some point in their lives to want to feel adored, to stand out, to feel special, to feel admired, right? And this elemental feeling, this elemental desire, is the engine to a lot of audacious goals. I mean, this is why someone wants to become a Navy SEAL or a famous singer or a world-renowned surgeon or, you know, teacher, or you name the profession. But even a great dad or a mom, I mean, that feeling of being recognized that way is a very human feeling. And so I had to add it into the driver categories because it's a very human element. And I think as humans, we have to recognize our humanity in all of this and say, okay, narcissism, when moderated appropriately, can be a very, very incredible driver. Now, the caveat is it's if it gets overboard, you start getting into the disordered stuff and it's a bad thing. And it's like a vampire staring in the mirror. In other words, you can't see it in yourself, right? It's really very visible in others, but it's hard to see in ourselves. So the inoculation to that is to surround yourself with the trusted, loving people who are willing to and will always give you that completely radical candor and that truth when you need it. You know, hey, Rich, you're getting a little bit out of over your skis right now. Tone it back a little bit. You're getting big headed here, right? That's my wife. These are grounding ones.
Yeah. Exactly. I was just going to say, you know, whenever you start feeling that way, you know, remember somebody's got to take it.
That's right. Yeah. And so your family does this. Or your wife, my wife's my grounding wire. Your teammates can do this. And so as long as you don't surround yourself with sycophants, which is a sign of narcissism, you're keeping yourself inside of a circle that keeps you in check and doesn't necessarily always put you at the center of attention. That's important too, okay? Because if you're always wanting to be the center of attention, then you're tipping over into that too much narcissism. But I think we have to recognize our humanity and celebrate a controlled level of narcissism that allows us to set audacious goals.
And you know, and since I started reading your book, you know, we had the whole Super Bowl thing, and I just started looking at, you know, the people that were very, very highly successful. And a lot of them had some of those traits, you know, like Tom Brady. You know, he got picked number 199th. And when the owner came to him, he called him Kyle Brady. And he said, sir, my name is Tom Brady. And by you picking me, it was the best decision you'll ever make. I mean, can you pitch, imagine a seventh round pick saying, that's the best decision
Right.
you've ever
Yeah.
made? So I guess, had that little balance of, self-confidence, but also a little self-narcissist to be able to tell the owner of the New England Patriots, you just picked me the 199th player in the league, and it was the best decision you ever made,
Absolutely.
you
Yeah, I
know?
think that's a great example. And yeah, you just it's a very human thing. The key is use it effectively, so that it'll help drive you towards those audacious goals that you might have.
So can you please talk about, your book and also what your mission is
Well,
now?
yeah, and so I think my mission, I'll start there. My mission and my passion is human behavior, and what and can we deconstruct human behavior down to some of these elemental qualities and cues and things, so that every person can start to figure out what their own engine looks like, right? So like I usually make an analogy with automobiles. Like, we're all human. It's just like every car is an automobile, right? But some of us are Jeeps, and some of us are Ferraris, and some of us are SUVs. Now, there's no judgment there, because the Jeep can do things the Ferrari can't do, and the Ferrari can do things the Jeep can't do, right? But the challenge is lift your hood up and figure out what type of engine you are, because without knowing it, you might be a Jeep trying to run on a Ferrari track, or you might be a Ferrari trying to run on a Jeep track, right? So I think the key to our own human potential is first, very first, self-exploration and kind of figuring out what engine we are. And so the attributes book kind of comes from that idea, because attributes are innate qualities. These inherent qualities that we're all born with. We all come up to that. We all show up to the game with different levels of, right? So we all have all of the attributes. The difference in each one of us is the levels to which we have one. One person might be a level 8 out of 10 on adaptability, and the other person might be a level, 3 on adaptability. There's nothing wrong with that. To judge it would be like to judge someone's hair color, right? But or judge our own hair color, right? The key is in that kind of palette that you come to the table with. What are your competencies? So, how do you show up in challenge, uncertainty, or stress, and what drives your behavior? And then from knowing that, you can say to yourself, okay, are there some attributes that I'm a little low on that I didn't know, and I actually want to develop and work on those? Which you can do. You can actually develop attributes. It just takes it, you can't do it the same way you can learn how to ride a bike or drive a car. It takes self-direction, it takes self-motivation, and it takes a deliberate march into the unknown. So if someone wants to say develop their patience, they have to say to themselves, okay, I want to develop patience. I am now going to throw myself into environments where my patience is tested so that I might develop it, right? So it's going to be uncomfortable, but you can develop these attributes. And I think this type of knowledge is what really drives me. It's what drove me to write the book. And when you read the book, I think you'll agree, the book is not about Navy SEALs. It's not about top athletes. It's not about super high performance. It's really about the reader. And when you read it, you'll start to understand yourself, ask questions about yourself, and say to yourself, okay, how do I show up in all of this? And hopefully begin to deconstruct some of your own behavior so that you may do even better.
And I love, like I said, I love your book and I love Brent's book, because they weren't about the Navy SEAL. It was about, improving yourself. It's a, you know, it was, it was, it wasn't, those, all these stories about, going into Afghan. It was more of a, this is a learning and a
Right.
teaching tool. And I think, that it makes a big difference, because there's a lot of books out there that are
Right. I
fluff.
agree. Yeah.
And you read it and you're like, okay, I could have seen this in a movie, but what has this
Yeah.
got to do with
That's right.
me? So, your book, you can actually internalize and use it as an SOP in a way. Now, being, 21 years in the military, and, most of the people that are listening to this are veterans or entrepreneurs, they're both. What are some of the attributes that we've learned from the military that can serve us in the civilian
Yeah,
sector?
well, so we certainly develop attributes in the military, and I think depending on the discipline that you're in the military will depend on the attributes, right? So one of the things about attributes is that the list of attributes to be a Navy SEAL, for example, is going to be different than the list of attributes required to drive tanks, or required to drive ships, or fly airplanes, or whatever. And so And so that's so the subjectivity actually matters. However, I will say that the military holistically going through boot camp or any type of training and the kind of that requirements to be able to operate in uncertain environments will always develop things like courage, will develop perseverance, will develop adaptability, will develop situational awareness. I think discipline is developed. I think self-efficacy is developed. And then hopefully if you're in leadership, well, so all of the team ability attributes are developed in the military because you're so often part of the team. And I think if you're in a leadership position, hopefully those attributes of leadership are developed as well. But that's not for certain. There are some people, there are some leaders in the military who are simply in charge. They're not leaders. And there's a difference between being in charge and being a leader, right? It often gets conflated, but it's not the same thing. Being in charge is a noun and being a leader is a verb, right? It's a behavior, not a position. And so this, you know, and by the way, you don't get to call yourself a leader. That's like calling yourself, you know, funny or good looking, right? It's other people who get to decide whether or not you're a leader, whether or not they will follow you. And that's all based on the behaviors that you execute to allow them that decision. So,
you know, I love that. You know, like I seen a t-shirt once that one time said, heroes talk about themselves, but legends
totally
get talked about.
Totally. That's so true. And as it is, so goes with leadership too. I always say if someone walks up to you and says, I am your leader, run the other direction because they don't get it. Right. So, and we all know that the great leaders in our lives, whether they be military, professional, personal, they are not people who designated themselves as our leader. They're people who simply behaved in a way that allowed us to say, you know what, I would follow that person anywhere. And all of us veterans can relate to this, right? Because we can think of times in our career where, yes, there was a commanding officer. Yes, there was a senior enlisted, but there was also that like E nothing over there that every time there's an issue, people went to him or her, right? Because they behaved like a leader, right? So leadership comes from people who say, I will follow that person. And it's not necessarily always the positional aspect of it.
You know, like I said, I was talking, you know, with Brent and John, and they, you know, they were talking about servant leadership, you know, and there's certain people that I could say, you know, that was in my career that I would literally run through a wall if they would ask me to do it. Just, and you know, the biggest thing, you know, I'm a big Zig Ziglar guy, you know, and he always says, you know, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And caring about your team members, I think, is more important than anything, especially being, if you're in a leadership position, you definitely need to care and get to know your people on your team.
Yeah. And they'll feel that too. I mean, they'll feel, I mean, you can't fake it. You can't fake caring. So, and how do you care for people? It's a behavior, right? And you spend time, you listen. So a buddy of mine always says, you know, likes to say, and he's totally right, is that time is the currency of leadership. Because we all have the same amount. When we give it, we're never getting it back, right? And so when you give your time to someone in your span of care, and you listen to them and you take time and you show them that you are invested in them and their future and their success, and you got their back when they fail, that endows you as a leader in their minds. I mean, they will then choose you as a leader. And that's the real kind of juice of it. And I know I was always in charge of something as an officer in the Navy, right? And I know throughout my career, and I, you know, did a lot of leadership jobs to include commanding officer of a SEAL team. And I know that there are many folks who considered me a leader. And I know that because a lot of them said so. They said, hey, I really loved serving under you while you're commanding officer. You really helped me. But there's also a lot of folks who I was just the guy in charge, right? That was it, you know, and it was because I wasn't behaving in a way that allowed them to make that decision. So you're going to get both. And any leader needs to just endeavor to behave that way, and they will at some point turn around and see people following them.
Yeah, but that's funny. Like anytime, you know, on social media, if somebody, you know, friend requests me and I see the word influencer in your profile, I run it far, far away.
Yeah, it's an assumption. It's a pretty weighty assumption, I would say.
So the last two questions I have, because I appreciate your time, and I know your time is very precious and valuable. how do we get in touch with you? How do we get the book? How do we get in touch with, you know, all your courses, whatever you have going
yeah,
on?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the best place is theattributes.com, the website, theattributes.com. There you can find the book. You can, there are links to buy the book. We have an assessment tool that we've created. So it's a free assessment tool. So you can go there and you can take an assessment on where you stand for the grit attributes, where you stand for the drive attributes, where you stand for the mental acuity attributes. I'm still working on the leadership and team ability assessment tools. Those are a little bit more complex, but the people can go and take those ones for free. I've thrown some workbooks on the website. So if people want to know and learn how to develop each attribute, they can grab a workbook and start working on some attributes they might want to develop. So theattributes.com. And then of course I'm on social media, LinkedIn, and then Instagram are the two main places. So hit me up any of those places. And yeah, definitely appreciate the support.
Now, the last question I ask everybody, because you know, I ask 100 different people and I get 100 different answers. You know, we're in such busy times, and you know, we're in 2021 now, you know, we're crazy, chaotic times. If I ask somebody to do the average person to do something in 7 days, mm-hmm. it's never going to get done. But if I say, Rich, I want you to do something in the next 24 hours, I want you to take an actionable step, you're more likely to do it. So if you know somebody that's struggling with their transitioning out of the military or even their military career, what is something they can do in the next 24 hours to start the right?
Yeah. So I'm a big believer in the concept of asking better questions. And just a quick dive into that. We are neurologically designed. Our brains are neurologically designed to answer questions. We do it unconsciously all the time. But if we take conscious charge of that and we lodge a question into our frontal lobe, our brain has no choice but to answer that. It just happens. And I've done it. You can do experiments all day long and just ask yourself any question and just take out a piece of paper and just start writing answers. So your brain's going to start coming up with answers. All right. We often do this the wrong way. We say, why does this always happen to me? Why am I so bad at this? Why are all these people out to get me? Right. We can take charge of this, and high performers always do this, right? They ask better questions and they ask themselves, all right, what can I learn from this? How can I grow? And so if you are someone who's struggling and you don't know what to do, take some time and ask yourself some more empowering questions. And one of the first could be, hey, who's out there that can help me? And start making a list. And don't let yourself off the hook, okay? Because you'll come up with a couple answers and then you'll feel like you can't think of anything. Just keep on asking yourself, what else? Who else, right? There's so many resources out there. There's so many people who want to help out there. You are not alone. And you can find people to help you in under 24 hours. You'll probably do it within an hour, you know? And so stop for a moment, take some time, ask yourself some, get out a piece of paper and a pencil, ask yourself some empowering questions and start writing down those answers. And then you'll come up with an even better question and ask yourself that question, but take charge of the quality of questions you ask. I'm a big believer in this idea that that the quality of our lives is directly proportional to the quality of questions we consistently ask ourselves. And so if we take charge of that and consistently ask ourselves good, positive, empowering questions, it changes our lives almost immediately.
Wow. Guys, there you heard it from the man, the myth, and the legend. Rich, thank you so much for coming on. I'm so grateful that you took the time. And I appreciate you, and I consider you a friend and a family and a member now. If there's anything I can ever do to support you.
Well, thank you, Richard. Thanks so much for having me. It's been such an honor. And yeah, let's stay in touch. That offer is reciprocal. So let's stay in touch and thanks for having me on. And thanks to the whole audience, as teammates, as brothers and sisters and fellow veterans, and even veteran supporters. We're all one big team. It's a pleasure to be part of that team.
Thank you and have a
blessed day. You as well. Thank you, Richard.
Blessed day.